And that's an example of where I think the pharma mindset, this molecule, this highly selective option, has really got us lost. THC became sort of the hyper focus of the industry. We've gotten closer and closer to pure THC, whether it's a vape cart that's 90%, or whether it's called THCA crystals, which they've taken what was once a plant resin and created a pure crystalline compound, and that's freely available on the market.
Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today we have a very special episode, actually an episode that was requested by many people in the audience who wanted to hear about cannabis. And so I sought out, as I often do, the best of the best on the topics that you request. And so I'm here today with Dr. Cody Peterson. Now, I have a few quick bullet points. Dr. Cody Peterson, pediatric pharmacist with over a decade in clinical experience, chief science officer at the Kenigma, a science-forward cannabis media company, holds a PharmD from Duquesne University, and honestly, a whole lot more. So, Dr. Peterson, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike, I really appreciate you having me. I wish I would have got like a green microphone or something to match.
Well, with the AI tools now, I could probably Photoshop something in there for you.
Make me glow green.
You got it. Yeah, that'll grab some attention for sure.
Thanks for having me, man. And I guess for the audience who's listening and wondering about cannabis and where this really blends in. So not only am I all of the things that you mentioned, but I also went back to school and got my master's degree in cannabis science and therapeutics from the University of Maryland. That's sort of how I sharpened my teeth in this space. And then I decided, you know, not dissimilar to you, to start making content. And over the past 5 years, I've kind of made a name for being somebody who's talking about this really actually complex and relatively niche, at least in the field of traditional medicine, topic that I think needs more attention. And so since that time, I've been able to get an associate professorship at University of California, Irvine, where we teach a 2-credit elective to pharmacy students and bounce all over the place and do some other things. So also, you know, taking this knowledge and getting it into pharmacists, because I think there's a real lack of understanding within the medical community about why cannabis may be helpful. And, you know, most people are pretty aware of the challenges and the side effects, but even that is still pretty niche.
And I think even more niche than cannabis itself is pediatric cannabis, because I mentioned at the beginning, pediatric pharmacists, and you're here talking about cannabis. So cannabis for kids, can you help me understand how that fits into this picture?
Yeah. I mean, I should point out, that's not necessarily my primary role. I still work in a hospital traditional pharmacy. But yeah, I've absolutely helped children, you know, navigate the world of medical cannabis. And the truth is, you know, while children have their nuances, they're still humans, right? And they're still, you know, vertebrates, and all vertebrates share this same system that THC interacts with, the endocannabinoid system. So it should come as no surprise that we can leverage cannabis medicine to help children. But being a pediatric pharmacist, I see the sickest of children in our society, whether it's cerebral palsy, you know, paraplegia, chronic seizure disorders, mental illness. You see this whole gamut of the sickest children among us. And I gotta say, every day I'm like, yeah, this person could probably benefit from cannabis. Now, keep in mind, I've still got my white coat on, and I can't really recommend that in my traditional setting. But there's no doubt that cannabis can help countless children for countless different disease states that they may be suffering from. And, you know, we all just think of it as like, oh no, cannabis bad for children's brains. But actually, the data that supports that is all derived from recreational use, from teenagers who decide to pick up a marijuana pipe. And there's no existing evidence that medical cannabis, given under the guidance of a medical professional, has deleterious effects on a child's brain. So I think there's no reason that we can't leverage cannabis medicine, not just THC, to help just thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of children across the country and the world, obviously.
And they're already, as far as I know, kids are already, of course, depending on the context, given things like opiates, amphetamines, antidepressants, things that...
Across the board. No one says, oh, you shouldn't give Adderall to children.
Right.
But Adderall is amphetamines, right? And no one says that when a teenager develops anxiety disorders that they shouldn't get benzodiazepines, even though benzos are associated with countless deaths. And a lack of brain development, and abusing benzos at a young age is associated with numerous deleterious effects and mental health disorders, et cetera. So these same rules apply to all these other prescription meds, but we don't talk about them in that context because those are legal and prescribed, whereas medical cannabis still floats in this pseudo-legal space.
Now, I often like to play devil's advocate on this show and be skeptical, even with the positions and the people I agree with. And so just thinking of what you said, someone might say, well, there's a lot more research on something like amphetamines and opiates and antidepressants, of course, in the centralized scientific model that we've criticized in the past on the show. But I guess my question here is there actually good science on cannabis, whether it's for pediatric or just in general?
Yeah, I mean, cannabis is probably the most studied plant in the world. No one has dedicated more time to looking at it. Unfortunately, most of that funding and money has focused on the adverse effects. So we don't know as much about the benefits, but we've got a very good handle on the negative effects of cannabis. Some of the challenges becomes, again, without being a legal medicine, there's a lot of questions about the inputs in these studies. When you say someone was a marijuana user, what does that mean? What is the concentration of that flower? How often were they using? By what delivery system? Was it a bong? Was it a capsule? All of those factors fall into the gray and almost get fuzzy because of the illegality of the plant. But we have studied this thing to no end. To say, though, some pediatric evidence, we do know that we have an FDA-approved drug, and it's approved in numerous countries around the world. It's called Epidiolex. Epidiolex is essentially a distillate or a concentrated version of a high CBD plant. So it's a plant-based cannabis extract, concentrated down and given to children with complex epilepsy disorders. And it's FDA approved for 3 conditions. And frankly, they're still working on opening it up to even more. So we've got good evidence there. Additionally, we've got pediatric indications and great evidence going back to the 1980s that says that prescription Marinol, prescription THC, can be used to help with increasing appetite in cancer and reducing nausea and vomiting. What's kind of crazy about that, though, is that's THC made in a laboratory. Currently, the THC made in the plant, its original version, that's still illegal. But this made in a laboratory, identical molecule, is FDA approved and prescribable by physicians. So the contradictions go on and on and on. And we'll learn about them as the show goes on. But it doesn't make much sense.
Oh, I mean, it makes you wonder. I wonder why that might be. I mean, they're making all this money off of it. It's such a frustrating thing going on. But I love how I was writing down a question and you answered it right as I was writing it down. So it does sound like the first pharmaceutical version that you mentioned is not a synthetic one. It started with an E. What was it?
Well, actually, the first would have been Marinol or prescription
dronabinol.
That goes back to the 1980s, 84, 85. And that was before we even knew how the medicine worked. We just said, oh, hey, these people who were struggling with HIV seem to be withering away, and cannabis or marijuana seems to help them. So the FDA went ahead and greenlighted that way back when. The Epidiolex, which is prescription CBD, was only approved in 2018 for a very small subset of conditions. But as you said, they're making money off of it. That drug sold $900 million worth of revenue, not profit, revenue, just last year, expected to hit $1 billion this year, which makes it, by definition, their own definition, a blockbuster drug.
Weren't there issues with Marinol?
There is controversy mostly surrounding its efficacy. A lot of people feel like it isn't as effective. Keep in mind, it's not a plant extract. It doesn't come with a multitude of molecules that may or may not help a medicine work better, but instead is a very pure, isolated molecule. And there is definitely a lot of talk that it's not as efficacious, but no one's ever really done a study looking at herbal cannabis compared to Marinol, because again, herbal cannabis, as it stands today, at least in the United States, a Schedule 1 substance. That is a substance that is highly addictive and has no medical utility, which is a little bit funny because we know that THC, this thing that is approved, is present in the vast majority of those plants. So that's kind of the controversy. And insofar as Marinol being controversial, it's probably not the most controversial prescription cannabis medicine. They've made synthetic cannabinoids, so not just produced synthetically, but manipulated synthetically with added appendages. And the FDA had approved those before too, despite having far higher potency or much higher attraction to the receptor and causing much more intoxicating side effects. The FDA had no problem approving that because it was a pharma-style drug, a one molecule that went through the traditional system. One of the biggest challenges is, especially with the Schedule I status, is botanical cannabis doesn't fit the mold. And when it doesn't fit the mold, the government has a tendency to reject it.
For the longest time, I've seen CBD in like everything, in supplements, and I mean, just about anywhere you can get it.
The
gas station.
Soup, I saw one.
So that kind of made me think it just became so saturated that I just thought, this clearly does nothing. They're putting it everywhere. It does nothing. So, I mean, from what you've described, it sounds like it is having an impact. It's actually helping people. Can you tell me a little bit more about CBD, what's going on there, and you know, how it's actually working?
Yeah. So you kind of need to conceptualize, if we got to go back way in time to sort of understand where cannabis was. But cannabis has long produced CBD and THC in varying amounts before we even knew what they were. And until the 1930s, cannabis, even though we didn't really know what THC and CBD were, and we certainly didn't have the tools to look for them, it was present. And cannabis was a medicine in the United States. Even pharmaceutical companies like Eli Lilly were making their own strains, and they were using those strains to treat patients right here in the U.S. of A. It was only in the 1930s that it was made illegal and removed from what's known as the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, when they removed a lot of plants in that same time frame. Just, you know, because of the modernization of what pharmaceuticals are. Now, when you fast forward, CBD really came back roaring right around 2018, which happens to be the year that it was reapproved pharmaceutically as Epidiolex, but also when the Farm Bill, the 2018 Farm Bill, changed the definition of hemp and marijuana and the legality of it. So they redefined it and said, you can grow hemp, which is any cannabis plant that has less than 0.3% THC, the psychotropic or the psychoactive component, the one that makes you high. So when that changed, CBD flooded the market. Farmers ran in, they said, finally, I can grow this cannabis. But the problem was there was no good supply chain for the fiber and the fuel and the seeds that might have come with it. So all these farmers made a bunch of CBD and they didn't know what to do with it. And hence there was this explosion of CBD popping up everywhere and every which way. So it was really only 2018 that you remember seeing it everywhere, because before that it was pseudo legal at all, and farmers certainly weren't allowed to farm it. Technically, 2014 there was a research program under the 2014 Farm Bill, but it really became mainstream in 2018. Exploded in popularity, went into everything. Like I said, pillowcases is the funniest example that I can think of. And you know, it kind of became complicated. Most people tried it for a little bit, didn't think it helped, and sort of fell out of vogue. So now you don't see nearly as much CBD around as you did. The thing is, though, is I wouldn't say CBD does nothing. In fact, I would say it's the opposite. It does so many different things when we look at it pharmacologically, when we look at it underneath the scientific microscope, that it's really been hard to pin down for whom, what it'll do, at what dose, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think that it does nothing. I think that it's extraordinarily varied molecule, and this is explainable through its pharmacology and its structure.
Hey, have you noticed how broken conventional medicine is, and it only treats symptoms instead of solving root problems? I mean, it's no wonder more people than ever struggle with chronic health issues, stubborn weight gain, low energy, and plenty more challenges. Actually, here's how Mike, a client of mine at Avantia Health Optimization, feels about our hyper-personalized approach.
Number one, you save me focus of attention. I have other things that are pressing and pending. I no longer have the playing time. So I need somebody to help me get the information I need specifically. You're saving me hours upon hours of time, but you're also saving me the youthfulness and clarity you have of cutting through the chase. So you have saved me time, financial money, the thinking, and the labor, the intense labor, and that is worth all the money in the world.
So as most of you know, I'm Mike Vera, board certified health and wellness coach, host of Healthy and Awake podcast, and founder of Avanti Health Optimization. We deliver hyper-personalized coaching addressing lifestyle as the missing link. Whether you're battling chronic health challenges, aiming for sustainable weight loss, or you're a busy executive or athlete needing peak performance, I'm your guy. Your first session is just $1, so you can try out health coaching, get a feel for it, and you can visit AvantiaHealthOptimization.com or visit the link in the show notes. So check out Avantia, because your health deserves solutions that truly work for you.
And so that what you mean by that, I'm guessing, would be looking at the endocannabinoid system, kind of the effects that it's having throughout that.
Yeah, it gets even more complicated than that. To put it simply, if drugs are keys and inside your body you have receptors, places where drugs act, those are locks. THC has a very rigid structure. You can think of it pretty much like a key you'd stick in your lock. It goes in and it really activates these two locks called CB1 and CB2. This gives us relatively predictable effects. People know what THC feels like. CBD, however, is like a floppy key. Right in the middle of the key, where THC is rigid, CBD is floppy and it spins all around, which throws an entire curveball into what we would say of predictable. And so what I would say is that while THC is a very well-defined, cleanly cut key, CBD is like a half key that sort of wiggles in certain spaces and it jiggles for some people. And it's going to depend more on the individual taking that CBD and what their underlying predisposition is and their challenges are, whether it'll work or not, which has created a real challenge on understanding who and what for and how around CBD. If we look at it pharmacologically in the traditional pharma sense, THC is a pretty clean cut molecule. It's got two, maybe four places it acts in the body, not places, four locks that it interacts with in the body. CBD is currently estimated to have 65. I've seen 120 estimated. It does a lot of different things in ways that we haven't been able to predictably predict.
It makes me wonder, because I've heard you talk about the endocannabinoid system in the past, and the way I've heard it described makes me wonder if it's basically like a vitamin, for lack of a better word. We have this innate system in the body that seems to have all these profound effects, and when you introduce some form of cannabis into the body, a lot of people report feeling some kind of benefit. So could it be that we are kind of meant to take in this in some fashion?
Yeah, you could throw that out there and certainly argue with someone about it. I would say that's probably not the case. So going back to what a vitamin is usually an essential component found in the foods that we have that becomes a cofactor that's involved intrinsically in a bodily process. So it's already, a vitamin is usually embedded into an enzyme or embedded into a system in the body. You have this system, the endocannabinoid system, is a master regulatory system present not only in us, you know, primates, not only us humans, and not only monkeys, primates, not only all mammals, cats and dogs and, you know, bears, but also in birds and lizards and almost all life on planet Earth shares this endocannabinoid system. And so what is it? Well, it's a lipid signaling system. It is a system that runs off of fat that helps the body maintain balance in this crazy dynamic world. Sun comes up in the morning, we get hot. Sun goes down in the morning, we get cold. We have to change. Oh, we jumped into water. How does the body have to respond to that versus being dry? Humidity, everything around us is changing. How does us, the body, or let's scale it down, how do tiny little organisms respond to all of these stimuli? And that is what the endocannabinoid system, using fats, which if you can remember back to basic biology, all of our cells, all eukaryotic cells, that's us eukaryotes, have a lipid membrane around the outside of each cell. You're made up of trillions of these. Now, if that cell wants to talk to another cell, what's the most available communication device? Oh, I'm going to grab a fat from my lipid membrane. I'm going to send that fat as a message. It'll be received by that system. Then that system can reintegrate that fat into it. So it is a cellular signaling system. not a body system, not just a couple receptors. It is diverse and widespread throughout all life on planet Earth because lipids are abundant and we need to respond to the crazy, dynamic, always changing world that we live in. And so can CBD jump in and tickle those same systems of signals and receptors and channels? The answer is yes. But is it a vitamin? I would say no. It is a plant molecule that has found a way to tap into this master regulatory system for whatever reason, right? You could make an argument evolutionarily. It's so we picked it and we grew it. But the argument that probably more sincerely is that it's a defense mechanism. It helps protect it. It helps deter pests. It helps do all of these important functions that occurred before humans were ever in the picture.
What about the role of the isolated compounds? Because we've talked about THC, we've talked about CBD, these isolated compounds taken from the plant. And I've read about something called the entourage effect, which, if I understand it correctly, just covers the synergistic interaction. So is that kind of, let me actually, if I may, just share one quick story. Please. I had a previous guest, Dr. Robert Lufkin, and I asked him about really insulin and blood sugar and particularly what would happen if we took someone who ate a full apple versus someone who basically broke down all the chemical pieces of an apple. And he told me about a study where they did that with applesauce versus a full apple, and the body processed it significantly different. Mm-hmm. And so I do wonder, okay, we have this system that clearly can process CBD and THC, but should they be processed in isolation or should it be together in a package? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I follow you completely. Look, if you want to do it the traditional pharmaceutical route, the route that has been occurring since plants were removed from the list of medicines we were supposed to use, and we're supposed to be using one molecule and one molecule because it's predictable. We know exactly how much you get. You know, there's an argument to be made for that side of things. However, I think there's a strong argument to be made on the other side of things as well, suggesting that plants could indeed provide positive or negative entourage effects. So as I mentioned, the system that we're hijacking, right, that THC hijacks relatively predictably, is all throughout our body. It's different inside of all of us. It's different at different times of the day. And it's different based on your genetics and your diet and your lifestyle. So when I introduce THC alone, that's still relatively predictable. But when you introduce THC alongside terpenoids like limonene or beta-caryophyllene, which do indeed have knowing pharmacological effects, that there is some sort of interaction between these molecules that we can't understand, that we haven't yet wrapped our head around. And I'm not sure that we will anytime soon. But if that combination results in a different effect than that one molecule, that's what we've defined as the entourage effect, these two molecules working together. And not just two, we're talking about dozens of molecules interacting with thousands of different receptors on millions of different cells on your body. So the idea that we could give one molecule and always predict how it's going to work, it's a fallacy. It's the dream of a pharmacologist to say one molecule, one target. And that's the way pharma and pharmacy schools and pharmacology has been carried out for the last 100 years, almost 200. But before that, doctors weren't looking to isolate one thing from a medicine. Our ancestors were not, you know, doing double, triple dilutions to get this one thing. No, they added a whole plant. The eye of Newt didn't just have one thing in it. I'm just being hyperbolic there. But, you know, we used to leverage this as plants working and interacting together and their whole constituents, and it has to be grown correctly. And now in the traditional pharmacology training, we are very reductionist. And I do believe it's a mistake. That said, I don't think that every entourage is a good entourage, right? It's possible that a plant with multiple components could be working against itself. But sometimes that's desirable. And I want to give you an example. What do you know about heroin?
I know it's an opiate that primarily works on the dopamine pathways, very
right,
addictive.
Definitely feels dopamine.
That's about as far as I can think of off the top of my head. Hey, do you spend a lot of time looking at screens like your phone, the TV, the computer? Well, that can actually lead to some pretty severe disruption in your circadian rhythm, which messes with your sleep, your hormones, your energy, your mood, your clear-headedness. It can actually disrupt quite a bit. Well, Boncharge has life-changing solutions to enhance your well-being and prevent some of those issues. Their blue light blocking glasses, which I'm actually wearing right now, have honestly transformed my life and even the lives of many of the people I work with. I regularly hear how quickly people's sleep improves once they start using these glasses at night. Plus, their red light therapy devices and other wellness products offer cutting-edge health benefits. So click the link in the show notes to shop and support the show, because every purchase helps me keep bringing you great guests and impactful content. Now back to the show.
First and foremost, it's an opioid and not an opiate. And the reason I say that is opiates come from the opium poppy, and opioids are synthetic derivatives of those. Okay. So then if we look at, okay, where does heroin come from? Oh, it's a derivative of morphine. We acetylate morphine and we get that. So let's go back to morphine, an opiate found in the opium poppy. 200 years ago, they figured out, hey, this is the magic stuff in opium. We better start isolating it, right? So that we can get rid of some of these nasty side effects and get these very predictable morphine effects. And that was great. Except when we did that, we turned opium addicts into morphine addicts. And then when morphine addicts tried heroin, we turned morphine addicts into heroin addicts. Because the more we isolate, the more we pull away, the more potent effects we got. That's, it tickles that dopamine more, that more addictive potential. But also we got rid of some side effects, some nausea, some dry eyes, dry mouth, some really undesirable side effects, right? Undesirable. However, we didn't have 100,000 Americans. There wasn't an America back then. We didn't have hundreds of thousands of deaths globally from opium back then, because opium had an entourage that created its self-limiting. Not good, right? It made the effects worse. It was less enjoyable. It was less, but we had a protective mechanism in that plant. And as we isolated it and went from morphine, then to heroin, and then eventually to fentanyl and other synthetic derivatives, we've gotten increased dangers, increased addiction potential, and we've gotten away from what the plant and nature offered, which was this mix of opiates. It's not just morphine in opium. It's codeine, it's thebaine, it's noscapine, it's papaverin. All these molecules together created the drug, the plant drug of opium. But when we got to isolate them, we lost that. And it turns out those were protective. So my contrarian view of the last 2 years is bring opium back. We want to save people's lives, allow people to grow plants and extract them, not sell them on the open market, but don't make that illegal. Make fentanyl illegal as hell. Put those people who are selling that drug in jail. And if people want to or become addicted to opiates, let's keep them on the plant extracts that doesn't take them out. Is it perfect? No. Can they still, you know, have a lot of negative consequences from opium and not fentanyl? Of course they can, but we wouldn't have people dying left and right. And that's an example of where I think where pharma and the pharma mindset, this molecule, this highly selective option, has really got us lost. And then I would argue that cannabis right now is kind of lost in the same sauce, not a good thing, because THC became sort of the hyper focus of the industry. We've gotten closer and closer to pure THC, whether it's a vape cart that's 90%, or whether it's called THCA crystals, which they've taken what was once a plant resin and created a pure crystalline compound, and that's freely available on the market. Not that it shouldn't be, but it's going the same direction. And I would argue that we need to go back to what made the cannabis plant this amazing medicine, instead of, oh, what's the money making drug, what's the one isolate. And just to kind of cap that all off, that's why I say that cannabis isn't a drug. Cannabis is a plant. Opium is a plant extract. Cannabis rosin, a plant extract. THC is a drug, right? It's that doesn't make it bad. It doesn't make it good. It's just we need to use the right words in order to get to what we're actually trying to talk about. So my shtick is regulate plants like plants, and regulate drugs like drugs. And I think that America and the world would be far better off if we stuck to that.
That makes a lot of sense. And the opioid example that you gave, I think, highlights it perfectly. And I was thinking, I know people who have eaten coca leaves and said, hey, you know, you're climbing up the mountain. They, the whole culture there, you eat coca leaves. And I felt fine. It gave me energy. It helped me. And then they, based on the same principles you apply, where the pharmaceutical model to like isolates this variable, and then it causes a whole downstream of bad effects, even though it alleviates some of the good effects. You see that in so many different places. I think saffron would be the one comparable, like that leads to MDMA. Is that right?
Ooh, so saffron, the flower, sassafras,
sassafras. I know there's
sassafras. So I was like, saffron, I need to learn. Saffron is the highly prized spice. But it, in both cases, yes, maybe a little. You know, I don't know that sassafras alone has a lot of value as a medicine. The challenge with DMT, which is where you're going there, is that it's not orally available. But look, I think this could be played out over and over. We're looking at mushrooms have become all the rage right in the last 5 years, right? And now there's competitions. Who can make the highest psilocybin mushroom? Who's got the most potent one? And we're running down this same path where there's hyper focus on one molecule instead of what's the whole picture? What other molecules? What does baocystine do next to psilocin in the mushroom? Is it beneficial for whom? And getting more towards I'd rather see chemodiversity be the focus rather than concentration, right? Mm. Which is where we're going again with mushrooms. They've got 4%, 5%, which is crazy considering historically, if you look at the natural sources, most of them are about 0.5 to 1%. And now we're at 5%, 6%. And everybody's breeding for this purpose. And I really hate to see, you know, the mushroom industry, which eventually I believe will be its own thing, make the same mistakes as the cannabis industry. And we already saw the coca industry do something similar. All of it with this mindset that, you know, everyone just wants to get high or everyone just wants this one effect. And I think the truth is that everybody's different. And if we focus on making it a more diverse, a broader medicine, they will be able to help more people with fewer negative effects.
Well, what are some of those negative effects? Because surely, you know, it's, you know, there is kind of in the culture as it has gained acceptance, there is an element of, hey, this is great for everything. It's perfect. There's no harm whatsoever. And yet, if you do look around, I do see some, if you're predisposed towards psychosis or schizophrenia, it's very dangerous, or even the classic how it affects motivation and it's going to make you a lazy stoner. So can you talk about some of the risks that people might want to look out for?
Totally. You know, I'm a pharmacist. Side effects, adverse effects are a big focus of mine. And I think that we see a pendulum effect in life, in politics, in everything that's going on around us. And I think one great example of this pendulum effect is cannabis is bad. You know, Nancy Reagan, war on drugs. This is your brain on drugs, to like, oh, everything is great. Oh my God, it's the godsend and it's better than everything. And everything sucks except for cannabis, and everyone should have it with their morning, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So first and foremost, the side effect that's closest to my heart, not necessarily the most common at all, is cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. So
is that real? Because I've always thought that was like some kind of fake thing, because I've never heard about that before.
It's extremely real, my friend. Extremely real. So I'm a pediatric pharmacist working on the front lines in Southern California, and I see kids come in, healthy adults, with their only medical thing is that they smoke weed every day, mm-hmm. and they can't stop vomiting for days, sometimes weeks at a time. Otherwise healthy. Maybe, you know, they're sad or they have a little bit of depression, anxiety, but like in general, this is very real. So we did a study.
Sorry, real quick. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to interrupt. Is that kind of a new thing? Because I do feel like it kind of came out of nowhere. I've never heard about this before, or maybe it just happened and they added a term to it.
Well, listen, let's be clear about this. There's never been a time in the world, particularly this country, where everybody's smoking as much weed as they are now. So, right. So we naturally see side effects come up when you get broader population adoption and more higher doses with the potency raise, as well as frequency of use. It's acceptable to smoke weed every day now. Thank you, Snoop Dogg. In some ways, I truly mean that. So where I'm going with that is cannabinoid hyperemesis is a syndrome, which is a collection of symptoms that results in bouts or episodes of extreme nausea and vomiting that doesn't respond to any of the medicine and appears to be driven through regular use of cannabis, regular long-term use. Usually people consume for a few years, if not longer, before developing this vomiting condition. So it was first described in the medical literature in 2004, 2005 in Australia, believe it or not. And since that time, we've seen a pretty significant uptick in this problem. So it's very much real. We don't know what's causing it, and we're trying to get to the bottom of that. So myself and a few other smart individuals, we did the largest survey of CHS sufferers that's ever been done. We had about 1,200 participants. We're trying to better understand who's getting this condition, why they're getting it, where they're getting their marijuana, right? Is it a contamination problem or whatever? And what I can tell you is people get it from home grow. People get it from the dispensary weed. They get it from their plug weed. They get it from the hemp online market. We've seen it across every single thing. Ethan Russo, who you mentioned, I think, earlier, if I recall correctly, maybe it was my last call. Sorry, forgive me.
No,
it was the man who named the entourage effect that we talked about just a bit ago. And he's done a study and he's identified a few genetic differences that may be predisposing certain individuals that when they consume high dose marijuana for long periods of time, that they develop this vomiting condition. So that's a side effect that isn't well known. It's controversial because, again, it's sort of new. People don't understand where that came from. But I assure you, it's very real. As far
and
as
it
psychosis,
seems,
go
just
ahead.
Real quick, it seems paradoxical, too, because I know cancer patients who smoke to alleviate nausea.
Yeah, totally. But I'll give you another paradoxical effect. If you use morphine for quite a while, your pain tolerance goes down. And now you need morphine to not feel pain and not be sensitized. Does that make sense? So yeah. It's not that abnormal to think when I expose someone to something that treats that thing, that over a chronic period of time for certain individuals, they'll develop an increased or sensitivity to it. So I don't think it's that hard to imagine that if THC can treat nausea and vomiting, that chronic long-term exposure could end up resulting in a dysregulation as it relates to nausea and vomiting. Because you're spot on. In fact, that's one of the FDA approved conditions. It's FDA approved for chemo-induced nausea and vomiting. People use it to help them eat. People use it when they were wasting away, suffering from HIV. It's just that this master regulatory system, it's not one directional. Remember, it's a balancing system. So when you slant it all the way to one side for so long, there appears to be this rebound effect, so to speak. It's happening. That's what I need to know. I don't know why. I don't claim to know why, but I want to understand better. It's a huge research focus of mine. It's like the next task of my to-do list is to work on the paper right now. Can't share too many of the results, but really interesting. But what I can assure you is it's happening across all sourcing. It's happening mostly to heavy users, meaning everyday users, but it comes in a range of symptoms and a range of sort of clinical pictures.
That's got me thinking about so many questions, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about was tolerance. And you would think if it's heavy users, I know people who could smoke, they might as well wear an oxygen mask, like a mask that's just constant smoke.
Yep.
And I just find that surprising. I believe you. I'm not.
I know. We don't. It's not uncommon. So let's jump to anxiety. Right. Okay. So a lot of people claim come to cannabis hoping to help treat their anxiety. And that tends to work. It can be for many people, although not everyone. Some people get paranoid and anxiety with their first hit, right? So another one of these, it goes both ways depending on you, depending on the cannabis you're consuming and depending on your tolerance. But if you look at big studies that say, okay, you have anxiety and you also report cannabis use, they see an increase in anxiety and depression, something that most cannabis users will say they use cannabis for, in chronic long-term users. And why is that? Is it because the system is now gearing up for a baseline? And then when you're not in that baseline, you know, you are anxious or depressed or whatnot. So this cannabis medicine, because we're dealing with a master regulatory system, it doesn't just fit or go one way. It can go both ways. There are certainly individuals that have a dysregulation with no cannabis. They try cannabis for the first time, boom, they feel normal. This is exactly what they report. I've never felt more me. I've never felt more okay. Yeah. And there's other individuals, as soon as they touch cannabis, oh my God, they're freaking out. They're losing, they're crawling out of their skin. They're anxious to no end, because it has to do with our own personal set point. Then it's a moving target. Chronic exposure or chronic introduction of THC, I'm using THC, but any cannabinoid would apply here, can then change where our baseline is, where our balance is. And then without the molecule, the body is in a different state than it with it is. So it's a moving target. And it's not a it's not a stable thing. We have a dynamic system because this thing is meant, the system that it's acting on is meant to help us respond to the dynamic world around us. Let me give you another example on this psychosis, which I think is an important one to touch on. There are some individuals with a small amount of THC. One of my best friends is one of these individuals. Above 30 milligrams, they're somewhere else, right? It almost is a psychotic inducing event. And there's good evidence to say that high dose, particularly edible cannabis, in certain individuals can cause a true psychosis, which is a break from reality. The example I like to give is, I'm not going to mention his name, sorry, buddy, is we made these incredibly potent Keef brownies in college. And my best friend, very sane human, right, has been smoking weed for a long time alongside of me during those college years. He goes, I think I'm growing horns. I'm serious. I think I'm growing horns right now. And I'm like, that's a weird thing to say, right? But high dose THC, especially edibles, can cause acute psychosis in most people, not everyone, and dose matters and all of these things. Now, that is different than causing schizophrenia, which is chronic psychosis.
Right.
And there is a subsection of people who can have these, can't have introduced cannabis, can go into acute phase of psychosis, but then that converts into long-term psychosis. We believe that those individuals were already predisposed, were already likely to develop or at risk of developing schizophrenia, which is, again, a chronic psychosis. Mm-hmm. It's likely that THC can do that in some individuals. Not likely, it's known, right? Yeah. And it is true that in many individuals, a large enough dose of THC can cause acute psychosis. So that's all real. The problem is trying to lump everyone into, yep, marijuana causes psychosis, right? But many of us have tried marijuana and we're like, I don't get you. You don't get it. So that's because, once again, it has to do with our underlying system. It has to do with how much we use, at what age, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no doubt that using marijuana has been associated with an increased risk of psychosis for multiple reasons. One, we know that acute thing can happen, but also two, there's this underlying genetic predisposition for schizophrenia. So it's this, you know, multitude of systems, this multifactorial process that really dictates a lot of these adverse side effects. And we're all different. And that's why it's really important that people are counseled, know the risks, and know to start slow. Some people can slam THC all day long. Other individuals will develop nausea. Other individuals might develop schizophrenia. Some individuals might develop anhedonia, or the lack of pleasure in other things that they're doing. Some won't. Some will just live their life like no different. Other people will become desperately depressed because marijuana has sort of dysregulated their motivational systems, which is, again, related to dopamine, which we keep coming back to today.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. And I've had so many discussions on different diets and food on the past episodes, and people respond differently to different diets. I know people who thrive on the vegan diet and people who just had a terrible experience. Same thing with carnivore. So
I'm keto right now because I feel great.
Yeah.
But not everyone does. Some people, they're like, I could never starve myself. I'm like, well, set that aside. You just, how you feel on a diet drives whether you're going to keep doing that diet. And for me, that works, but not everyone, it's not for everyone.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, any dietary change is directly connected to the system that I'm talking about. So the endocannabinoid system runs on fats. Where do you get fats? From your diet. And how do those fats get processed? Through your microbiome. And so there is great evidence to suggest all of this stuff swirls your childhood traumas, your exercise routine, all of it blends together to make you, and your response, especially to plant medicine, unique.
Wow. This was such a powerful episode, and I really thank you for your time. And I know we're getting close to time here. So was there anything else that maybe we should talk about before we hang up this call?
Yeah, I mean, I just want people to know that if they are curious about cannabis, that they have resources available to them. So the Kenigma, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, has been sort of my baby for the last few years. There's so much information, a download of my brain, so to speak. So Kenigma.com, you can get all that stuff. We've been offline for a couple of years, and by offline, I mean online, but not producing new content. But we are charging back up to create new content, and that's where you can learn all sorts of the stuff we talked about. You can just Google Kenigma and psychosis, and you'll find an article about exactly what we talked here today. So if you're curious to learn more about that, that's what you should Google.
Cool. Well, I'll be sure to put a link to all your stuff in the show notes. I encourage folks to check that out. I'm looking at my sheet here. I have so many more questions that we didn't get to. So hopefully we get the chance to talk again in the future, because I really do appreciate the value and insight that you brought today. And other than that, folks, stay healthy, stay awake. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought, or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.